G'day and welcome to Life Matters. I'm Cassie McCullough and today we're going to meet an 18th century Highland warrior. Well, kind of. We're going to meet the Scottish actor Sam Heughan, who plays Jamie Fraser in the cult hit series Outlander. He's a true blue heartthrob, this one. He's been mobbed by female fans during his visit here ahead of the arrival of the second Outlander series, which is based on the much-loved books by Diana Gabaldon. But you may not have heard of him. Make sure you stick around to meet him. We're also going to take some time out today to look at the way the Australian media has covered the Port Arthur massacre. Now, you may know that the 20th anniversary of this event is looming, and we're going to be seeing and hearing a lot about it all over again in coming weeks. Author and journalist Sonia Vumard has written a book about the two decades since and the role the news media has played in shaping our cultural memory of this event. And a little later, some history on the life of Mae Gibbs, the author of Snugglepot and Cuddle Pie and many other things in between, it turns out. Doesn't it just warm your heart to think of Snugglepot and Cuddle Pie? That's ahead of us on Life Matters. Now, as I was saying, next month on the 28th of April, it will be 20 years since the Port Arthur massacre took place. Many people lost loved ones that day. Many people were injured. Many of us simply remember where we were when we heard the shocking, unfathomable news, violence on a scale that was barely comprehensible. But many people in the surrounding communities suffered in the aftermath in ways that are less easily quantified: depression, marriage breakdowns, suicides. Undoubtedly, as this sad date approaches, news streams will show us stories, images, words. Rightly or wrongly, we'll be reminded of what happened. Once again, it will be a media event. Journalist and author Sonia Vumard has been reflecting on the moral and social issues of the storytelling of this tragedy. She's written a book. It's called The Media and the Massacre. Sonia, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Now, the coverage of this event has necessarily been intensive, but sometimes moments have been better than others. How do you see the bigger picture of the Australian media's efforts? Have we struggled with the moral challenge of reporting this story?
Yeah, we've absolutely struggled. I mean, it was an extreme news event, the likes of which this country had never seen. So we were writing the rules as we went along, and the coverage ranged from the very good to the very bad. The Age newspaper did a very good job and won a Walkley Award for comprehensive coverage. But then you had other extremes where one of the newspapers digitally enhanced a photograph of the perpetrator. So, you know, you had the full gamut. And in the past, I think, sort of 20 years, we've had various examples of the kind of commercial storytelling machine rehashing those events for not necessarily in the public interest, even though the public would be interested in it.
Mm. And we should put on the record that you have been a journalist for Fairfax throughout that period.
Correct.
In a few different roles, but not directly covering in the events in that time.
Yeah.
Now, you write that the news media have been custodians of the cultural memory of these events. In what way? What do you mean by that?
Well, journalists are often the first witnesses to major events, and certainly they were very on the ground at the time when this happened. They have a responsibility, and many of them take that very seriously. Others get driven by career advancement and so on. And so people react in different ways, just as all humans do. And I think many people felt the need to try and explain, to try and interpret, and that played out in various different ways, with some very good writing, but also some bad examples of people climbing over fences of Carlene Bryant's house, for example, to get to her, and what might be regarded as quite sort of harassing behaviour.
You actually write about that moment where the people who have been traumatised in this event are still being attended to, being removed from the area in coaches, as what's called the Trench Coat Brigade arrive. Describe what you mean when we say the trench coat brigade.
Sure. Veteran journalist, ABC journalist actually, Judy Tierney, I spoke to, and she is a Tasmanian and was very involved in the storytelling around these events, and I think is one of the most articulate people on it. And she wrote a piece on the 10th anniversary of the massacre, and subsequently I spoke to her about it, and she described how when she arrived at the holding place where all the journalists were being kept, as the victims were still being, the people who had survived were still being moved out from the site, and she said that there were a large number of journalists who were not from Tasmania, many of them from the mainland, and even I think some by that stage were starting to kind of filter in from overseas. They were all gathered at this particular site, and there was a really sort of weird vibe, she said, and there was a lot of kind of black humour and a sort of I can handle anything and a bit, you know, fast and loose behaviour. And she described how at a certain point, buses started filing out from the Port Arthur site with the lights on. This was late into the night, and a lot of the people on the buses had very pale faces. She said it was like an Edvard Munch painting. And she said a number of the journalists sort of rushed forth and tried to sort of jump towards the buses in an effort to get to these victims. And she said her heart leapt because she said these people were in no state to be talking to anybody.
And there in that one scene, we see the central dilemma, because there is a story and those people in the media have a job to do, and there's also people suffering. And you've written a lot about the work of the Dart Centre, which is, it helps journalists navigate this route of having to cover traumatic events and also do it with compassion and responsibility, and we'll get to that. But already earlier this month, we've had quite an extraordinary report on Seven's Sunday Night, Mike Willis's major event report, which included never-before-seen video of police interviews with Martin Bryant after his capture, and an extensive interview with Bryant's then lawyer, John Avery. And we were shown documents that he's kept, including drawings by Martin Bryant. Many people are still curious, and maybe there's always going to be that human search for answers. But is this a legitimate impulse, and what role does the media have in feeding it?
I think it's a very human impulse. That particular footage was compelling. I couldn't help watching it myself. But by the same token, I'm not sure that it was in the public interest. I don't think it necessarily did anything to advance debate. But nevertheless, I'm sure it rated extremely well. And that's the conundrum that we as journalists and storytellers are faced with, you know, whether or not to sort of go down that more tabloid route, that more sensational route, or whether to you know, show more restraint and sensitivity towards those who are affected by these events.
Yeah, it's every case has to be taken on its own value, and we can only judge you know, each one on its own. In your book, The Media and the Massacre, which is a reference to Janet Malcolm, the journalist, author who wrote about a case in which a reporter became more like the perpetrator in a case. But you focus on a one case study. Now, this is a 2009 book by the Fairfax journalists Robert Wainwright and Paola Totaro, Born or Bred, Martin Bryant, The Making of a Mass Murderer. Now, it became the subject of legal action and also an investigation by the Media and Arts and Entertainment Alliance Ethics Committee. At the centre was a dispute over the use of a draft memoir by Martin Bryant's mother, Carlene. Without going into the details of it, what was the central problem in your eyes?
Well, I think Carlene believed that she was talking to them about collaborating on a book to tell her life story, which she did want to tell after all those years. And she shared that draft memoir with them, in her view, on that basis. She then didn't like the way the relationship was going, so she opted out of it. And as a result, they went on to write a book of their own, including excerpts from her memoir. She believed and stated, and this was why the legal action resulted, that she had not given them explicit permission to use her memoir, and that in some respects was echoed in that complaint process that you referred to.
Yes, and the case was settled out of court and it's subject to a confidentiality agreement. But the MEAA's Ethics Committee looked at allegations of acting dishonestly in using material and exploiting vulnerability. Now, they found in favour of the journalists, but it does serve as a kind of point where Australian media practices were really analysed quite closely, and there's obviously going to be much to say about the ins and outs of it. What about the Tasmanian people? How are they going to respond to this next chapter in their experience of this?
Well, I think the Tasmanian people really want to move on. You know, they want to, as I think Margaret Scott, the great late poet who wrote a poem about those events, she said they want to cherish life, but they also want to move on. They don't want to be defined by those events. They still remain very traumatic, partly, I think, because of the smallness of the community down there at Port Arthur. There are still many people who work at the Port Arthur site who were somehow connected to those events. So it's a very intense place and an intense experience for the community. So I think, you know, as you referred to the DART Centre, and they talk about events like this, they should be covered in three acts. And I think by now with Port Arthur, we should be getting to the third act, which is to put these events into a broader social and emotional context and to try and learn from them rather than to rehash and re-traumatise those who are affected.
Okay, so that's the third part. It's a kind of, well, I guess it's almost a agreement about what has happened, and so that can solidify and move into its proper place in our cultural memory.
That's right. I guess you could call it a form of acceptance. I mean, maybe it echoes the sort of the stages of grief, but it has been 20 years, and I think people don't want to see all those images rehashed again, so that they feel like they're stuck right back there where it happened.
Well, it's not just the people of Tasmania, but people who are visiting as well. And you write about, you know, the feeling for those people if they do see these images. It's not just, oh yes, that happened. They are back.
That's right.
Exactly where they were.
That's right. And when you pull out those images from the days around those events, you know, the people who were caught on a cherry picker or seen running from the scene, you know, it makes them feel all that trauma once again.
Mm. You, in the process, we're talking with Sonia Vumard, who is the author of a book called The Media and the Massacre, which looks at the coverage of Port Arthur and the events there in 1996 and in the ensuing 20 years. You've been there. Tell us about how you were drawn to this as a subject.
Well, I've always been fascinated by Tasmania, and I had never been there, and so I was also, as a journalist, obviously compelled by those events back in 1996. So even though I didn't cover it as a journalist, I write in the book that I've always covered it in my mind. So I was drawn to go there when I saw this ethical challenge that had been thrown up with the writing of the book Born or Bred, and I decided to go down there and have a look and just see what it felt like. And it was those events are still very palpable in all of the atmospherics around there, even though some believe that they've been played down. But even just going on a bus to Port Arthur on a sort of $100 tourist trip, there was a woman on the bus who told me that she had been sent by God to go and work with Martin Bryant. So it just shows how much the Port Arthur massacre does still haunt our nation. And then when you go there, the tour guide warns you, or warned me, us, that it wasn't really a good idea to talk about the events of 1996. And so because I was there on that express mission, I sensitively approached the desk at the site, and I asked about, I didn't say the words Port Arthur massacre, I said, could I please see the brochure about the events relating to 1996? And they very quietly and discreetly sort of reached for this brochure and handed it to me. And I realised that it was a matter of great import and one had to have a certain emotional etiquette around it.
Mm, that we should learn how to use our language with care.
Absolutely, yeah.
Not yep. just this event, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, it also, this whole experience for me brought up how much we need to respect our subjects as journalists, that, you know, we tend to treat them as our own sort of objects, and I think there needs to be a lot more kind of intelligent emotional interplay between subjects and journalists, and that's the responsibility of the journalists primarily, but I think it would be good if subjects can be more educated about how to stand their ground with journalists.
Journalists are really trained to only allow their voice to be heard. Ethically, sometimes it's you don't allow the subject to have any input into the product, because you know the idea that way corruption lies.
Well, but that's right.
I mean, say this is
there's a very big difference between interviewing a politician and a business leader, and interviewing, you know, the victim of a tragedy. I mean, when I first started as a cadet journalist in 1980, I remember our bosses used to tell us that victims of crime often liked to talk to journalists because they found it sort of emotionally comforting, which I just think is ridiculous. But that was the way we were sort of taught to learn how to break those boundaries, I guess, of going and knocking on a door of somebody's house who may have lost a relative or been through something very traumatic.
Well, as this grim anniversary approaches, I hope that the media approaches it with the kind of caution that you've shown. Thanks very much
for
speaking with
me,
Sonia. That's Sonia Vermaard. She's the author of The Media and the Massacre. We'll put details of where you can find it on the Life Matters program page. Coming up next, a complete change of pace, we're going to meet time-travelling warrior, Outlander Jamie Fraser.
Did you operate today?
I've had a cold.
Antidepressants.
I was taking antibiotics.
This is kind of a long-term study.
As a doctor, I do feel...
As the neuroscientist in my family...
This week, ABC has Our Health in Focus on RN.
Let's look at the issue here.
From head...
It's impossible to wrap one's head around...
...to toe.
If you're barefoot, you're getting maximum sensory feedback from your feet.
Our Health in Focus on Our ABC, right here on RN.
I remember every moment, every second. I'll never forget when I came out of the church and saw you for the first time. It was as if I stepped outside on a cloudy day, and suddenly the sun came out.
That's Jamie Fraser, an 18th century Highland warrior, talking to his love, Claire Randall, in the cult television series Outlander. It's a passionate romance that has driven fans around the world mad. But it's no simple love affair, because it's 1743 and the 6'4" kilt-clad Scot Jamie and his clansmen are being drawn into the second Jacobite uprising. And Claire is a married British army nurse who's just been serving in World War II. How can that be? Well, it's something to do with sacred stones and falling through time, and all based on the best-selling sci-fi romance novels by Diana Gabaldon. But unlike other narratives in this genre, Outlander's sexual politics are strikingly contemporary. This week I caught up with the Scottish actor Sam Heughan, who plays Jamie Fraser, and has been in Australia ahead of the global release of the second season of Outlander at the start of April. Welcome, Sam Heughan.
Thank you very much.
Now, for people who hear the words sci-fi romance and recoil in literary horror, these books, they set out a narrative which is, well, it's been described as feminist. It's a story based on a woman's experience mm-hmm. of
Well, romance, time travel.
Yeah, the novels. I mean, Diana Gabaldon wrote this collection of books, and she's written 8 now. And, you know, they're very hard to pigeonhole. You know, there is obviously a central romance to the novels, but there's time travel, there's the historical side, which is very big. There's a supernatural side, there's a sci-fi side. There really is so much in these books. And the reason that they've been, you know, a New York Times bestseller many times over is because there's so much in there and there's something for everyone.
The general outline of the story in the first series, we have Claire Fraser. She's been a nurse in World War II. Mm. She reconnects with her husband. They go to Scotland to a second honeymoon of sorts. She somehow happens across some standing stones and is thrown back 2 centuries to the 18th century, where she comes across a bunch of Highlanders, including you.
That's right. Very fortuitously, I think. She goes to Scotland. It's, you know, after the Second World War. She's trying to reconnect with her husband, and they've grown apart. It's quite sad because there definitely was, you know, a young love there, but they're very distant, and they were very much affected by the war. She was, you know, a field nurse and has seen a great deal of suffering, and he likewise has also been affected by the war. So they go back to Scotland to reconnect, and this is where this sort of strange supernatural side comes, and she falls through time back to the 1700s, the time of the Jacobites and the Jacobite Revolution, and very quickly bumps into the enemy of the peace, which is Black Jack Randall, who is actually a descendant or an ancestor of her husband in the future.
And played by the same
actor. Played
by
the wonderful Tobias Menzies, who plays both characters. And yes, and then is rescued by this group of Highlanders. And in a very convoluted or rather complex, should I say, turn of events, she's forced into a marriage to save her from Black Jack Randall. The Scots force her into a marriage with my character, Jamie Fraser, and then, you know, over time they fall in love. But it is kind of a bit back to front.
Yeah, and just there we see one of the classic tropes of the romance genre, the forced marriage. But I think that's where the gender politics flip, because she's from the future. She has a far more sophisticated, modern idea of sexuality, gender politics, and here she is amongst these men who, well, you know, they're Highlanders. And in fact, your character, we learn pretty quickly on, is a virgin.
Yes, I think, you know, it's fair to say, you know, this is a strong female character, which actually is very rare in television and film these days. And actually, I don't know why we're talking about that being something new. And, you know, it should be the norm. You know, why is that such a, you know, such a shock for people? But yes, it's terrific to have this strong female character. And so she's from the future. She has a lot of prior knowledge and also a different way of thinking about things. And she's gone back in time and is being treated like women were in, you know, in the 1700s. And basically they were a second-class citizen. They were obviously expected to behave a certain way. And she by no means will do that. And through time, she sort of teaches Jamie, my character, about how to be more modern and about how to think differently. And he also is very forward-thinking, so he can make that mental jump. But there's always a clash between the two, because it's about, you know, his moral code, how things are done at that time, and obviously her from the future and having this prior knowledge. And that's not to say that everything that she brings from the future is right. In fact, he's from a time where things are a lot more dangerous. People live by their word. There's a lot of honor. And actually, you live and die by your actions. And she also learns that from him.
It's a really interesting dynamic between the two characters because, I mean, you say it should be more common. I think it's actually quite groundbreaking in that we don't really see a female character taking the sexual lead. And it's quite an erotic treatment. I mean, I've seen all the fan videos, I'm sure you have too, online, where people have taken scenes and remashed them with their favourite songs and brought out different elements of it. So it's clearly connecting with something, well, very intimate and personal with the audience.
Yeah.
What's it like to be in the middle of that storm?
Yeah, well, I think, I think what we've done with the show is, without trying to be groundbreaking, but we you know, we're trying to sort of make water cooler moments, but we are trying to tell the story of this relationship. And sex to them is very much, you know, a part of how they connect and learn about each other. And so they're young and they are learning about each other. And he's, you know, as we said earlier, a virgin. So it's about how these scenes move their relationship forward. And so we spoke closely to the you know, the writers and the producers about every moment that was intimate or even violent as well. There's a lot of, you know, there's a bit of violence in the show, but we didn't want it to be gratuitous. It's about moving the relationship forward. And so these intimate moments you see, I mean, I don't think they're any more explicit than any other show that's on television. But what we do is have some sort of intimacy that you maybe don't, you know, normally the camera pans off the couple in the bed and it's a soft focus, whereas we don't let the camera, turn away. And then we see moments where their relationship develops and where they fall in love and also learn something about each other.
Mm. Much has been written about this series being, well, for the female gaze, produced for women, by women, with a woman at the centre of it. And also it's been said that you're one of those rare actors who's comfortable with that gaze that allows the female viewer in. Mm. Why do you think you have that? How have you been able to create that as part of your performance?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, we don't make the show, you know, just for women. I think we make it for everyone, you know, and I think it just goes back to this thing that it's just rare to have, a strong female character, and it's told from her point of view, as the novels are. So we've tried to stick as closely to novels as possible, but ultimately it hits from her POV, and so she, as the viewer, feels and sees things in a certain way. So obviously, you know, we're going to see much of her side. But there are also episodes that we see from, without giving away too many spoilers, from season one, but, you know, we see it from Jamie's point of view, my point of view. So, yeah, it's refreshing as well. We had a great, you know, team that we worked with, the writers and producers, and we had a fantastic director, Anna Forster, who did a lot of the more intimate episodes, the wedding episode, but also the last episodes of season one, which were quite traumatic for many of the characters. And I think having that female touch has brought a sensitivity maybe to the show.
Yes. And the end of season one, without wanting to give away much for people who will catch up on it before season two, there is some extraordinary sexual violence, which is really, you know, hard to watch, and you're the victim of it. That's a brave move, isn't it?
Yeah. Wow. It's, yeah, without giving it away to those that haven't seen it. And if you haven't, you should catch up, because I think it's, as I said before, very surprising. You know, the show constantly changes. And by the end, this very strong character, Jamie Fraser, is subjected to sort of a physical torture, but also a mental one. And Jamie, as we learn in the show, can put his body on the line. But at this point, he is just taken to somewhere else. And actually, this evil character, this arch nemesis, Black Jack Randall, this British officer, he mentally scars Jamie. And I think that's just, it's fascinating. It's, you know, a different kind of hero that we're seeing. And certainly we see that sort of carry on into season two.
Yeah, it's a remarkable television moment, I think, because the storyline was about a male being in a situation that we are so often seeing women in. Mm. It's quite, well, it's remarkable for its rareness, I guess.
Yeah, and, you know, as an actor, I think being given that challenge and that opportunity, I certainly relished it, because, you know, a lot of television, you don't, you know, in theatre, that's where I come from, a theatre background, and I think you get a lot more opportunities to test yourself or challenge yourself on the stage. But in TV, you know, it can be quite safe, and it's just nice to be given something quite challenging. And you know, I'm very fortunate. I work with a great cast. Tobias Menzies, who plays Blackjack Randall, and Katrina Balfe, who plays Claire, are just, you know, terrific actors. So we trust each other. And I think that's what allows us to then go to these slightly darker places.
We're talking with Sam Heughan. He's one of the stars of the series Outlander. He plays Jamie Fraser. Tell us a little about that background in theatre. I think you started quite young. You were in theatre for young people.
Yeah, that's right. I was born and brought up in the southwest of Scotland, and I guess I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. I knew I was interested in theatre, but I didn't quite know how. I moved to Edinburgh when I was a teenager, and I started going to the Royal Lyceum Theatre in Edinburgh, and just fell in love with the theatre and was very fortunate that I joined the youth theatre there. and you know, through that process went to drama school as well. But it's, you know, it's something that I love. I think youth theatre is very important. I am the patron of youth theatre in Scotland, and you know, it's a terrific way for people to get into this industry, and not just acting as well. You know, our show, we employ hundreds of craftsmen, of plasterers, of labourers, people that drive cars, people that, you know, make coffee. It's such a vast industry, and one that's great for Scotland as well, and, you know, one that we should be encouraging people to get into.
Mm. So tell us about, you're on this tour, actually, I think, of going around the world, and we've seen the rise of the Comic-Con phenomenon, which is really where, wow, gosh, it's hard to explain, isn't it? Fans of shows, of series go along, they get a chance to hear from the creators, the actors. They often get tips on inside knowledge, and sometimes they even dress up when they go. What's that like? What is it like to walk on stage and there's screaming fans?
Yeah, I mean, it's all, we've now done two Comic Cons. They're this large convention which are primarily based around, you know, graphic novels and a lot of TV shows. And people, as you said, there's a lot of cosplay, which is where people dress up as characters and try and be as close to that character as possible. But it's vast. It's become really huge. And the one that we have attended twice now is in San Diego. And it's just enormous. You know, it goes on for many days. And there are thousands and thousands of fans of different shows. And it's a great opportunity for us, though, as actors, to leave the bubble that we're working in, you know, in Scotland, in the rain and mud, and go to sunny San Diego and see, you know, what actually people are out there that are excited about what we're making. And we do a lot of panels there, a lot of, you know, Q&As. A lot of signings, and it's just a really nice buzz of people that are just passionate about the work that we're producing.
Mm. I imagine it's pretty intense. Have you come across any convincing Jamie Frasers?
I've seen a few Jamie Frasers. I mean, it's such a strange place. I mean, I was on a rooftop in San Diego and looking down. We was having some interviews up there, and we had a group of Highlanders for our show that were walking around San Diego playing the bagpipes and chanting Outlander. And they happened to come across a group of Sharknado supporters who were all dressed up as sharks. And they had a dance-off in the street with the bagpipes playing. And it really was a very bizarre moment.
Very West Side Story.
And yeah, exactly. The sharks and the jets. And it was, you know, it was, you know, just, it's kind of bonkers, but you know, just a lot of fun.
Mm, gosh, there's 8 books or something in this series. You're going to go the distance?
We hope so. I mean, you know, who knows? I mean, we've now completed our second book, second season. I've actually been in this job for 3 years now. It's, time is flying by, but it seems to be building a lot. You know, it's all around the world. It's doing very well. It's great to come to Australia as well and New Zealand and see, you know, that the show is such a vast reaching fan base.
Well, if you haven't heard of Outlander yet, be prepared, because no doubt it will become part of your life soon. Sam Huyen, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
I should say that that series 2 of Outlander begins on Sunday, April 10, on Foxtel's Soho channel. It was amazing how the Life Matters team tripled during that interview. I didn't know that we had so many women working for us on this program. Cassie McCullough with you on Life Matters today. Coming up, we're going to hear about a program, well, it's about lived experience in mental health care.
My family loves the ABC. My granddaughter simply adores Giggle and Hoot. My son loves Doctor Who.
Exterminate.
And my wife, she thinks she's Annabelle Crabb in the kitchen. And I have to agree. Luckily, with the ABC Shop Online, shopping for the whole family is simple. Plus, you can earn VIP rewards and locate your nearest ABC centre. When my family's happy, I'm happy. Just one click and ABC Shop Online comes to you. abcshop.com.au.
They say that to truly understand how someone thinks and feels, you need to walk a mile in their shoes. If you're suffering from mental illness, that means the support of someone who's no stranger to the mental health system.
Louise Byrne has a history of mental illness, but she's using her experience in a unique way, teaching mental health nurses about the benefits of peer support. And Louise joins us now from Rockhampton. Welcome, Louise.
Thanks, Cassie.
Now, Louise, you're a doctor, actually, a lecturer in lived experience mental health at the Central Queensland University. Is this the first time an Australian university has had a title like that amongst its academics?
No, but it was the second. My role, the first was at University of Melbourne, a lady named Kath Roper, and then my position was a few years later, but it was the first full-time lived experience role of its kind that we know of in the world, actually. So that was pretty exciting.
So you're advocating for peer support workers in the mental health system. What does someone with lived experience offer?
Well, I'm advocating for peer support, but that's one component of the lived experience workforce. People with a lived experience are working in peer support roles. They're also working in systemic advocacy positions. They're advising government. They're sitting in representation roles on boards, committees, forums. They're also working in education roles and research roles like mine. So there's a broad range of spaces that people with a lived experience are contributing. And a lot of this is around the need for reform. And government and services and everyone's basically agreed probably 23 years ago that Australia urgently needed mental health reform. And one of the increasingly emphasised aspects of that is the need to hear from the people who access services in order to be able to provide service provision that is relevant and meaningful.
So in an ideal world, a lived experience worker would help bring about a shift in culture, a kind of transfer of power away from the clinician and the system to an empowerment of the patient.
Precisely. And that is the intention. And many clinicians and many services agree with that. And government policy indicates that that's the direction that we should be moving in. The World Health Organization shows us that that's the direction we should be going in, because patient empowerment or service user empowerment leads to much better outcomes. I think fairly commonsensically, when somebody feels able to guide their own healing, they're more empowered and they're more likely to take responsibility for themselves and do everything that they possibly can to move forward.
Louise, could you tell us about your experience? You have a history of mental illness that sort of began, I understand, in your mid-teens. What happened?
I had traumas, significant traumas around that age. An assumption was made that there was something biologically wrong with me, which wasn't actually the case. I think that if people had talked with me about the things that had happened to me and given me support and assisted me to heal from those experiences, things would have been very different. But that's not what happened. So instead, I was put on very heavy doses of medication, so much so that Mum said that it would take her hours to wake me up in the morning to try and get me off to school. It was almost impossible keeping me in school, and I did leave in year 11 initially. I was in and out of hospital. I was actually at that time being put into a geriatric ward because I grew up in a regional area and there was no paediatric space for children with psychiatric difficulties. So essentially I was, I guess, set on a very different path from what I would have thought that my life was going to be like. My diagnosis was very public. My entire community was aware of it. My behaviour was pretty out there, I guess, because I was very angry and upset and frightened. And so I was acting out because of my immaturity and my age. I was unable to find the words to explain what had happened and what was happening emotionally for me. So instead I was, you know, as many teenagers do, just sort of running around and showing people that I was upset but without actually communicating. I also felt that had anyone really wanted to know what had happened to me, they would have asked, and no one did. So I guess there was this code of silence, which happens for a lot of people who have mental health challenges. An enormous percentage of people who go on to have mental health diagnoses and significant mental health challenges have childhood traumas.
So while you were negotiating this system that really wasn't connecting with you, you were also so depressed. You were actually suicidal. You had attempted suicide on a couple of occasions.
I had, yes. And I felt like I had no value, really. I like initially the trauma, what had what had been done to me had significantly decreased my belief that I had any value. And then the fact that this label was placed on me, which again decreased my value. I was the psycho kid. I was the crazy kid, you know, and there was a lot of fairly open discrimination against me at that age, mostly from children, but from parents as well.
So in your case, you needed someone to really be that bridge between you and what was happening in your very fragile world and this rather harsh, brightly lit world of the medical establishment and the school and your community.
Absolutely. I feel like the part of the role of the lived experience practitioner, no matter where they sit, is almost as a translator, and we're able to sit in both spaces because we've sort of typically moved on a bit in our journey, and we're able to explain what was happening for us, and that also allows us to explain what's happening for other people to a degree. Everyone's experience is unique, but to help other people have a better understanding of what's occurring for someone who's currently so caught up in their distress and their their trauma that they're unable to speak coherently themselves.
Now, you say that people with lived experience of mental illness need to be in positions of authority for there to be real change. How difficult would that be in the current workplace atmosphere of the mental health sector?
I think a lot of it is about attitudinal change, which is happening slowly. It's about workplace culture. In some areas, in New South Wales, there's an organisation called Richmond PRA. They're a non-government organisation, and they've actually really taken these concepts on board, and they're now asking, why not a peer worker? So every new position that is developed at Richmond PRA, they actually have to argue, if they don't want it to be a lived experience role, they have to provide a good reason why not. And they're aiming to have half of their workforce lived experience. They already employ over 100 peer workers. So some organisations can really see the value. And I think it's a little bit of a chicken and an egg situation. In the places where there's less engagement with lived experience perspectives and roles, it tends to have been because they haven't had them before. In the places where they've had more lived experience involvement and they've been able to see the value that it adds, then they're more likely to have been willing to make structural changes and to look at their practice.
Well, Dr. Louise Byrne, you really have started a conversation, and it's all about normalising these experiences that many, many people have but don't necessarily talk about. I'm going to give some numbers in a moment, Lifeline and Beyond Blue. What do you think from your lived experience of those numbers being given when this subject is discussed?
My advice is always try whomever you think is the most relevant to you, but always listen to yourself. If it doesn't feel right, if the click's not there with that person and you don't feel like they get you and you get them, feel free to keep looking. So there's many services available. There's many different people out there, and finding somebody that you have a natural rapport with can really assist in your healing journey.
Thank you so much again for talking with us.
No problem. Thanks, Cassie.
That's Dr. Louise Byrne, lecturer in lived experience mental health at the Central Queensland University in Rockhampton. And those numbers, should you ever care to use them, are Lifeline 131114, 131114, and Beyond Blue 1300 22 46 36, 1300 22 46 36. Cassie McCullough with you on Life Matters. Gee, that was fascinating what Louise was telling us. Maybe you've got thoughts on the matter. Why not leave us a message on our listener line, 02-833-1430, 02-833-1430. Be keen to hear what you think of, well, the challenges that those ideas present. Now, to a subject close to so many of our hearts, gum leaves and gum nut babies, artist Mae Gibbs. Now, she imagined the bush as never before and gave us our own cast of mythical characters. Renowned as the author of Snugglepot and Cuddle Pie, Mae Gibbs was popular not just as a children's author, but also as an illustrator. Her illustrations of Australian animals and wildflowers found a home in magazines, in cartoons, on bookmarks, posters, postcards, and it's this bigger picture capture of Mae Gibbs that Robert Holden wants to capture in his book, Mae Gibbs, More Than a Fairy Tale. I'm delighted to say he's with us now. Welcome to Life Matters, Robert.
Thank you very much.
Now, she is remembered for all these works, but for me, what I think she was doing was actually describing the Australian landscape to many white Australians for the first time in a loving way.
She was, and that's a remarkable achievement. First of all, for a child, she was born in England, so she grew up for 4 years. She was 4 years old when she got here, so she had that preliminary experience in England and the English landscape and the animals there. And I think it's so important and significant that she was an outsider coming here. So she looked, what I'm saying is she looked with fresh eyes at the Australian environment, and she saw things there that perhaps we hadn't seen or appreciated. And yet now, we walk through the bush and we see a banksia tree and we go, banksia man.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's just extraordinary that she saw that. But the other amazing thing is before this, even from First Fleet days, the bush was very alluring, sure, but even convicts wandered off and were lost, starved to death, died from thirst, whatever. And then, of course, the epitome of that being Burke and Wills dying in 1861, obviously. So the land was something to be very afraid of, and it was threatening and terrifying and so on. But May turned that around. Although she necessarily put that element of threat in with the banksia men, of course, which is a very sensible, rounded moral universe then. But nevertheless, she made the bush a place of magic. She made it into what is a wonderland, in fact. And I think that is a great reversal and a great achievement.
Yeah, magic's the word, magic, isn't it? Yeah, so, you know, I suppose there's lots of, memories that each of us have around it. How much did she learn from what was already existing, what was already around when she came to work?
Do you mean in the
other images of the bush?
Ah, well, there were high art images, of course, like McCubbin's images, of course. I don't know if she would have seen any of those, but she did come from a very artistic family. Her parents had met studying art at the Slade School in London, and they came here, they came to Perth finally and settled, and they were very much part of a very vibrant cultural and social community there, which was just developing. And so from an early age, she got that great encouragement and fostering of her own talent. So, and that was extremely significant, of course. And her debut, if you like, as an illustrator, was nothing less than a double-page spread in one of the big Australian newspapers, a black-and-white illustration, very much in the Kate Greenaway style, you know, pretty little children playing at games and so on and so on. But 12 years old, double-page spread.
When was that?
What a prodigy. Oh, well, she was born in 77, so it must have been about 1890, something like that, yeah.
But the First World War came along, unfortunately, and she was sort of part of it. And her images of the gumnut babies and wattle were co-opted into a sort of patriotic version and vision of Australia.
May had been to London three times, chaperoned always, of course, to study at art school, and very, very professional training. In fact, it made her one of the most professionally trained of either sex back here in Australia. She arrived back, she fled, I think is the right word, London, as many people were, to come back to Australia in 1913. So she arrived back very providentially and safely. And she, in fact, really most of her work before that, and we're talking about almost 40 years, had been for adults in so many different ways, satirical and political cartoons. So she had done some children's work in London, commissions, fairly small ones, and she'd published one children's book there. But when she came back, she illustrated a very short story in a newspaper for Ethel Turner and put little gumnut babies in it, and that was the beginning of that. And she very sensibly was a businesswoman as well, and she registered copyright on that image in 1913, and then she produced this wonderful little bookmark that we all know so well. And it's to her credit, of course, that she realised there was great potential in this. And part of that potential was realised in that series of wonderful postcards for World War One that we so love and treasure and value today.
Describe them.
Well, my favourite one, of course, is the gumnut corps. And they say they're all, you know, the gumnut babies lined up with gum leaves down the front, and that's all they've got on, and a little stick over their shoulder as a gun. And it says, "We are the gumnut corps. We're off to fight the war. We'll make things hum by gum."
Aww.
Now, they were printed in their tens of thousands. And there's a whole range of them, and she, as she developed new characters, are incorporated in the cards. And I have to tell you that about, maybe 6 years ago now, I had a Mitchell Library Fellowship to work on their original Anzac diaries, which was a great honour, of course. But you never know what you're going to get when you put in an order for diaries, and up from the stacks comes a whole box of whatever, and there's letters. And a lot of the material the boys brought back with them from the front, things they were sent in Red Cross parcels or from their family, or whatever, which they treasured and kept and they brought back. It was not rare to find postcards, Maggie's postcards, even the little booklets, the five little booklets that she did thereafter as well, sent to the boys in Red Cross parcels or from the family, and that they'd treasured enough, these are the tough Anzacs, to bring back with them as mementos from them. Now, I think that tells you an awful lot about the boys, the innocent times they were in, and how significant Mae Gibbs was and to that whole war effort, that whole pictorial propaganda thing.
And that delicate sense of love and fun and delight.
Absolutely.
In the Australian
and
landscape.
Innocence.
Yeah. Now, she's an extraordinary woman for the time. That early, well, I guess, are you saying she's a graphic artist? Is that what we would call her?
Yes, you'd call her a commercial artist, an illustrator, a whole range of things, political cartoonist, caricaturist, certainly a wildflower artist. That was the first real exhibiting career she had from before she was even a teenager, and she thought she might become a botanical artist. But that close observation, of course, of botanical specimens in the bush stood her in good stead later when she could move from that into purely fantastic imaginative things. So she had a whole range of possibilities to explore, and she was, I'm sure, as surprised as anybody else that in the end she became totally devoted to children's things. But we mustn't, this is what this book is about, of course, that that first half of her life is so much for adults. There's so much adult work there.
And political.
Yeah.
I mean, she was in England in 1909, which was the height of the militant women's suffrage campaign, and she got involved in that cause.
This is all new material in the book. We had no idea of a lot of this before. She was involved in a front row seat, and I do mean that literally. She was at all the meetings, and she was commissioned by the suffragette movement to be there and watch the speakers and draw them at first hand, and then her illustrations were reproduced in as black and white covers for their magazine. And one of the very intriguing things I found in the London press was a Miss Gibbs, didn't have M. Gibbs, or might just had a Miss Gibbs, was one of the banner bearers in one of their militant processions in London. I would love to think it was May carrying that banner.
Wow.
Yes, a new image of May. May going to war, not just the gumnut babies.
What an extraordinary person. She really was just, forward-thinking. Well,
she was a lot more feisty than we imagine. I mean, when she came back, it's because she built her own wonderful little studio over at Nutcote on Sydney Harbour, and she worked so assiduously and just every day she worked, and she had to do that to produce the volume that she did over a lifetime. And the popular conception in the press, certainly, and in the public mind, was that she was a reclusive, studio-bound artist. Well, that's not true at all. I mean, and this book shows for the first time what an incredibly vibrant social and artistic life she led. And to think that she may have carried a banner in a suffragette movement, I think undermines
good,
that
isn't it?
Straight away.
Well, not only do we love her, we're now learning so much more about her. You've just been asked to write an entry for Mae Gibbs in a literary Wonderland encyclopedia. What's that?
How wonderful, and what providential timing. I mean, this came as an email only just over 2 weeks ago from a very big publisher in London. It's a 320-page encyclopedia. It's called Literary Wonderland, so it's about people who have created that.
So from Lewis Carroll.
Well, earlier still, it goes right back to Homer writing the Odyssey.
Right.
Yes, Lewis Carroll, and then right through to J.K. Rowling today. And the only Australian in there is Mae Gibbs.
Oh, wow. Well, I mean, of course, she should be,
absolutely,
and she must be. What a delight and what a pleasure to be just thinking of her. And you've spent so much time immersed in her work. It must be wonderful. Thanks so much for just a sliver of that childhood memory for us.
My pleasure.
That is Robert Holden. He's co-author with Jane Brummett of Mae Gibbs, More Than a Fairy Tale. It's published by Hardy Grant. Time now to check in with Michael Cathcart.
Oh, good morning, Cassie. I've got a party that Mae Gibbs could have gone to. She would have been in very good company.
Really?
Yeah, we're in Vienna. It's 1913, so we're in the glory days of Mae Gibbs. And At table, Trotsky, Lenin, Stalin, Freud, Jung, they're not getting on very well. It's all subtext and no conversation. Alma Mahler, who's at the start of marrying just about everybody who's clever. Tito, the Archduke Franz Ferdinand, yes. His wife. Yes. Can you imagine a gathering like that?
I think May Gibbs wouldn't have had much time for that lot. But they sound fascinating.
So she could have drawn gum nuts for them?
This didn't actually ever happen.
I don't think so. I think it's supposed to be funny. Whether it's funny, we'll find out shortly. And we're also talking of funny. We're going to meet. No, we're not going to meet. We're going to report in Arts News about the famous British artist who was married a rock.
Oh, gosh. Okay, well, all that with Michael Cathcart on Books and Arts next. Tomorrow we're going to bring you Anne-Marie Slaughter, a talk from the All About Women Festival. I'm Cassie McCullough. Have a wonderful holiday over the Easter weekend. See you next week.